On Saturday, July 11th, 1953, The Hague, a city on the coast of the Netherlands, was enjoying a clear, cool summer day. No one would have given a second thought to the man driving up the Laan van Meerdervoort, the longest avenue in the Netherlands, as he pulled up to a quiet park. The man was George Blake. He was an exemplar of British loyalty, a civil servant with a talent for languages and a polite, winsome manner. Stepping from the car, he tucked a copy of yesterday's newspaper under his arm. He scanned the park and soon spotted Nikolai Borisovich Rodin, seated on a bench, holding a copy of that same newspaper. George approached him. Rodin, a KGB intelligence operative, asked how everything was going. George assured him all was well. The British didn't suspect a thing. With that, the conversation ended. It had lasted fewer than 20 minutes. But in those 20 minutes, George Blake officially became a mole for the Soviet Union. This is Espionage, the Parcast original exploring the missions behind the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm Carter Roy. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. So let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information. This is our first episode on George Blake, a British prisoner of war who turned communist spy while in captivity in North Korea. This week, we'll follow George at the Berlin division of the SIS, where he covertly foiled dozens of attempts to intercept Soviet transmissions and, in the process, likely prolonged the Cold War by decades. Next week, we'll see how he was finally found out and yet remains free to this day. George Blake was born in Rotterdam, in the Netherlands, in November of 1922. His parents lived a simple, middle-class life in Rotterdam. His mother, Catherine, was from a well-respected Dutch family, while Albert, his father, was born in Egypt, but was proud to be a naturalized British subject and served with the British forces during the First World War. In 1938, Hitler's armies marched on Poland. Before long, they turned their sights on the Netherlands with massive bombing raids that destroyed George's home city. George had been staying with an aunt outside Rotterdam when the bombing commenced, and he returned to his home to find it empty. His mother had fled to England. Left to his own devices, George joined the Dutch resistance against the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands. It was here he began to learn some of the tricks of spycraft. As he transported resistance documents via train, for example, he learned to keep his bags at the far end of the carriage from where he was seated. That way, if the bags were searched, he could easily escape before they figured out who the luggage belonged to. Other times, he escaped by pure chance, as when he dropped a pile of illegal papers right at the feet of an older German officer, who immediately knelt down to pick them up. He barely looked at George as the teen spy thanked the officer profusely and hurried away. Though George never felt any personal connection to his father's Jewish heritage, it was clear that would make no difference to the Nazis as they cracked down on the Jews of the Netherlands. So at the age of 18, with help from the resistance, George sought to flee to England, his father's adopted homeland. With his real documents tucked into his shoes and forged documents in his pockets, George began his perilous journey across Europe. After almost 6 months, he was captured and placed in a Spanish prison camp. Spain's formerly cordial relationship with Nazi Germany had turned chilly, and the Spanish had temporarily opened up diplomatic relations with the Allied countries. When the British caught wind of George's plight, they negotiated his release, along with 15 other British inmates. Things quickly settled down once George arrived in London, but he still wanted the excitement of the resistance, of the fight, and to that end, he attempted to join SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service. SIS, also commonly known as MI6, had been founded in 1909 as a response to Germany's expanding influence. By the time of World War II, they had 145 agents working undercover in occupied France alone, and a vast network spread across the rest of Europe. For George, who had fallen in love with spycraft in the Dutch resistance, SIS was a dream job. A brief stint in the Royal Navy allowed him to maneuver his way into an interview with the chief of the Secret Intelligence Service, and in 1943, George officially became an agent of SIS. It was here that he served out the rest of World War II. By the end of the war in 1945, it was clear to both American and British leaders that the Soviet Union would be their next opponent. Churchill declared, "An iron curtain has descended across the continent," in reference to Soviet control of Eastern Europe. To that end, George Blake received a post-war assignment in Hamburg, covertly gathering reconnaissance on the Russians. After 2 years of impressive recon work, George's SIS superiors invited him to the intensive Russian language program at Cambridge, an opportunity he eagerly accepted. For 8 months, he was immersed in the language and literature of the Soviets, until a new opportunity arose. In the fall of 1948, the conflict in Korea had begun to heat up, with the Soviets supporting the communists in the north, while the Americans and British gave aid to the south. George was assigned to play the role of British vice consul in Seoul, South Korea. This title served to disguise his actual purpose, to intercept communications from the communist north. As preparation for this mission, George followed the old maxim, "Know thy enemy." This led to his first in-depth encounter with communism as an ideology, as he flipped through the pages of a book entitled The Theory and Practice of Communism, and found himself nodding along with the tenets described within. Obviously, Blake knew the dangers presented by the Soviet brand of communism, carried out by Stalin's totalitarian regime, but George couldn't help admiring the equitable nature of the philosophy itself. George arrived in Seoul in November 1948. He spent over a year cultivating important contacts in nearby Russian and Chinese cities, reaching out to potential communist dissidents and using them to make inroads against the North Koreans. But his progress was entirely derailed when the North Koreans invaded and occupied Seoul in June of 1950. On July 2nd, North Korean forces arrived at the embassy and assembled the staff, including George, outside. They were detained and transported to a series of prison camps. By winter, they were being held in a farmhouse in the North Korean countryside. George's captors were joined there by Soviet officials to help keep watch. The Russians attempted to indoctrinate the prisoners, giving them literature by Marx, Lenin, and Stalin. Blake devoured these volumes, his interest in communism as an ideology increasing despite the abuses he faced from its supposed practitioners. And by autumn of 1950, George's conversion was complete. George stepped out into the chilly night air. The others had long since gone to bed, but he was up and about, a folded piece of paper in his hand. He stealthily made his way toward the guard's shed. Inside, a Soviet major was holding court with his soldiers. As George entered, the major stopped talking. George put a finger to his lips. Shh. Then he handed the major his folded note and left. Not a word exchanged between them. The confused major opened the note to find a cryptic but intriguing message from his prisoner. George was offering information and connections that the Soviets may find appealing. After doing some research into George's past, the major arranged a meeting. Here, George opened up completely. He was not, as he had claimed, a mere diplomat. The vice consul had been a cover title for his real role in the Secret Intelligence Service. He made an offer. He would supply information about any SIS operations against the Soviet Union and other communist nations. The major found George credible. The prospective spy didn't seek compensation or early release from the camp. Instead, he simply, truly wanted to help the communist cause. When the war ended, the major decided, they would see if George could deliver on his promises. In November of 1952, Dwight D. Eisenhower won his campaign for President of the United States. 5 months later, Joseph Stalin died. These two events shifted the political landscape significantly, and by April 1953, the new administration in Russia had negotiated an exchange of prisoners. With their release legitimately arranged, George's promised betrayal could finally begin. With no one in Britain suspecting, he'd made a deal with the Soviets. The prisoners were transported to a town called Otpor, later renamed Zabaykalsk, on the Russian-Chinese border. Here, the captives were brought to a customs house and given procedural one-on-one exit interviews. But George's interview was not like the others. George was led down a long hallway, past scores of desks and secretaries, until they reached a small office at the far end of the building. In the dim back room, George was acquainted for the first time with Nikolai Borisovich Rodin, his case officer. They agreed on their first meeting that July in the Dutch city of The Hague, with a copy of the previous day's newspaper under their arms to signal that all was well. From Moscow, George Blake finally went home. Flying into Oxfordshire, England, the returned captives were greeted as heroes. George was ferried back to London and the War Office, where he was interrogated to determine if he'd been compromised in captivity. But his interviewers didn't suspect a thing. He was warmly welcomed back into the ranks of the SIS. He was assigned to Section Y, a brand new division that monitored transmissions from the Soviet Union. It was here that George began his subterfuge in earnest. Next, we'll hear how George used his position in the SIS to compromise British intelligence. Back to our story. George Blake had been a loyal British spy until his capture by the North Koreans in 1950. Indoctrinated with propaganda that fueled his already leftist tendencies, George had offered to pass information along to the Soviets following the war. When the war ended and he finally returned to England, George did exactly that. On a foggy October evening in 1953, George left his office at 6 p.m. He walked to Oxford Street, where he stopped in for a quick cup of tea. The tea was warm and comforting, but its real purpose that night was to provide cover and give George a chance to observe his surroundings and to see if he was being followed. He observed the faces around him. Nobody seemed interested in his business, and leaving the shop, George felt confident nobody had tailed him. He walked to the nearby London Underground station, Charing Cross and boarded a train. But just as the doors closed at the next stop, George slipped off. He waited for two more trains to go by before boarding again, now fully confident that nobody could be following him. After his final stop, George continued on toward the nearby Belsize Park. Here, his Russian contact awaited. It was a familiar face, Nikolai Borisovich Rodin, now operating under the alias Korovin, since they were in enemy territory. Korovin had, in fact, given George his first lessons in losing tails. Korovin was known to the British as a KGB agent, and yet still managed to meet George unobserved at an agreed-upon time. George asked him how this was possible. Korovin explained that a meeting with George at 7 p.m. meant beginning his own day at 8 a.m., devoting the day entirely to unpredictable movements that would shake loose any agents attempting to follow him. He never stopped moving. He coordinated with other KGB agents to swap places and cars with him at several points throughout the day. It was a tiresome process, but so far, one that had never failed. And Korovin's presence here at Belsize Park at 7 p.m. on the dot just reinforced his point. George handed Korovin a folded note containing a list of the wiretaps the SIS had been preparing on Soviet phone lines. It also gave the locations of hidden microphones in various Soviet facilities across Europe. Before any of these operations were up and running, George Blake had informed the Soviets of their existence. The wiretaps would be useless. Korovin then produced a small camera, a Minox, a favorite camera of the spy trade, thanks to its slim frame, which made it compressible and easily hidden. These kinds of miniaturized tools are critical to the spy trade. As counterintelligence agents pass constantly through heavily surveilled places, they can't risk giving themselves away, nor can they go without the key tools they need for their craft. During the Cold War, the CIA and KGB became experts at this kind of miniaturization. They made hollow coins that could hold tiny slivers of microfilm, compact makeup cases with messages hidden in the mirror, and even tobacco pipes containing advanced radio equipment. The KGB even invented a lipstick gun that could fire a single, tiny 177 caliber bullet when the end was twisted. And the compact Minox camera would be essential, Korovin reasoned, so that George could capture documents that couldn't easily be smuggled out of the office. This meeting marked the beginning of a regular rendezvous. Every 3 to 4 weeks, they would pick a location. George would sometimes board a train and step off at the next station and wait for the next train. He might repeat the process 2 or 3 times to ensure that nobody tailed him. But George didn't need to worry about being tailed. George, to most in his orbit, was above reproach. After all, he was among the most successful intelligence gatherers at SIS, thanks to the information his Soviet handlers were allowing him to pass along. Perhaps George's biggest betrayal came in late 1953, when he undermined what should have been a masterstroke of American and British intelligence. With Berlin split into East and West following World War II, the Russians controlled the East while the British and Americans oversaw the West. Though the infamous Berlin Wall had not yet been constructed, travel between the two sections was still somewhat limited, making espionage difficult. At a conference in Frankfurt in December of 1953, a joint plan between the CIA and SIS proposed a radical solution, Operation Stopwatch. SIS officer Peter Lunn first conceived of the plan, which would involve a covert operation to hollow out an underground passageway into Soviet-controlled Berlin, allowing them to access and wiretap Soviet phone lines. The British had carried out a similar plan, Operation Silver, a few years earlier in Vienna. There, the British had simply purchased a house near the intersection of several telephone lines and tunneled about 70 feet to tap them. But the scale of Operation Stopwatch was unprecedented. The tunnel now would be over a third of a mile long, from West Berlin into East Berlin. Once the tunnel had reached the other side, a vertical shaft would be hollowed out upward toward the communication lines that lay just underground. Then agents would place a tap on the lines. They estimated that they could capture 405 hours of conversation this way. That is, 405 hours every single day between the multiple lines. A fleet of transcriptionists and translators were hired. Mounds of dirt were hidden in massive, hastily constructed warehouses. Every possible contingency was prepared for. Power was the biggest issue, specifically the fact that wiretaps, when attached, could briefly cause the current running through the lines of communication to dim. The operatives couldn't risk alerting the Soviets to their presence. Once again, they devised a special wiretap with minimal power requirements so that it could be placed discreetly. There was, however, one contingency that nobody planned for. Seated at the back of the room, taking copious notes on the plan, was one George Blake. Afterwards, Blake made copies of his notes for everyone in attendance and then grabbed an extra set for his Soviet handlers. Barely a month after the conference, George stepped onto the upper level of a double-decker bus and found his Russian contact waiting for him. He sat down beside him and slipped him the memo detailing the plans for Operation Stopwatch, the tunnel project. The contact, Berlin KGB station chief Sergei Kondrashov, said that upon looking over the documents, quote, "I was flabbergasted. This was explosive material. I could not believe my eyes." He immediately passed the information up the chain. From day one, the Soviets knew about the tunnel, and they said nothing as the Americans and British dug their way into Soviet territory, tapped Soviet phone lines, and established a massive espionage operation that should have clinched the Cold War in one brilliant stroke of strategic subterfuge. The Soviets were thrilled with George's work, but if his professional life was going well, his personal life was even better. And it was starting to be a problem. George had been dating a secretary in the SIS office, Jillian Forsyth Allen, since he had returned from Korean captivity. Now it was 1954, and the two had been together for nearly 2 years, long enough for Jillian to be getting anxious to tie the knot. But George himself was less eager. He was terrified, in fact. For Jillian had no clue about his activities. In his autobiography, George described his state of mind. "I should never have allowed things to develop to this point. How to get out of it now?" He tried to put her off. He explained he was half Jewish, hoping her father's anti-Semitism might preclude marriage. But Jillian didn't care what her father might think. She loved him. And George loved her. And so George married her, fully aware that someday, if he was ever outed as the traitor that he was, he would shatter her world. The nuptials were accompanied with welcome news, to George anyway, that he would be receiving a transfer to the Berlin SIS station, which was the largest SIS outpost in the world at the time. Presented to the outside world as a British initiative to rebuild Germany, the building actually contained a network of intelligence operatives, technical engineers, and researchers. From his new office in Berlin, George was tasked with finding converts from the Soviet side, students, dissidents, or other possible sympathizers who might turn on the communists. This is a process practiced by intelligence services the world over. Viktor Suvorov, a Soviet intelligence officer, describes how one begins to turn an unwitting citizen to their side. Savorov suggests that these contacts usually begin socially, with a casual, friendly introduction. The intelligence officer might begin to trade favors with his new friend. The officer will obtain some valuable item for him, for example, or will help him communicate with his mistress in exchange for some little piece of information that might help the cause. The favors and the price escalate from there. Before long, a loyal citizen finds themselves deeply indebted to a foreign agent and helpless to escape. For George, this position was ideal. It allowed him to travel easily between East and West Berlin. The British thought he was going to find dissidents, while his Soviet contacts didn't need to risk crossing into enemy territory in order to meet. No longer did he have to sneak off to quiet suburban parks or shake potential tails on his way to the double-decker bus drop spot. Now communication was simply a matter of showing his papers and crossing the border between East and West Berlin. The political situation in Berlin gave rise to administrative quirks that made his job easier in other ways, too. At the SIS offices in London, photographing documents was a risky affair. George often had to sneak off to a closet and lock the door while he snapped sensitive memos. And if someone had ever attempted to enter the closet and found it locked with George within, suspicions would have been immediately raised. But things were different in Berlin, because once every 6 weeks, George was put on night duty. He was left to watch the SIS section of the building overnight, entirely by himself. George wasted no time. He spent all night snapping pictures of key files. He had the combinations to the safes and the keys to the cabinets, meaning no important document, however confidential, was beyond his grasp. In some ways, Berlin was where George's truest self was revealed. He frantically handed documents over to the Soviets, no matter the cost to the British men and women he worked alongside every single day. This kind of deceit is essential in spycraft, a profession with little patience for personal loyalties. George himself remarked, "Once one adopts the profession of an intelligence officer, one must be prepared to deceive and lie." It was something he'd shown an aptitude for in his home life with his wife, Jillian. And it should perhaps prove no surprise that he extended that logic to his own co-workers. But it was also Berlin that, in the end, would reveal George's deception to the rest of the world. Coming up, we'll find out how the walls close in on George. Now, back to the story. George Blake had returned from a North Korean prison camp to a London intelligence office in mid-1953, where he passed MI6 secrets shamelessly to the Soviet Union. During these years of spying on his comrades, George demonstrated little concern about the safety of his fellow SIS officers. He photographed cards listing every single British intelligence agent stationed in Berlin at the time, putting them all at great risk. In later years, he would claim that no spies had come to harm on account of his information, but people did die, including one vocal German dissident, Robert Bielek, who had moved to West Germany under SIS protection and yet was still somehow abducted by German communist agents, never to be seen again. After years of spying for the Soviets out of London's secret intelligence service, George Blake was transferred to the SIS Berlin office in early 1955. While this made his job easier in some ways, putting him in close proximity with the people he was passing information along to, it also created a great deal of tension for George. The various British intelligence agencies were on high alert in the mid-1950s, following the unveiling of the so-called Cambridge Five. This was a group of high-ranking intelligence officers who, beginning in 1951, shocked the British public as they defected or were otherwise revealed to be spies for the Soviets. First, British spies Donald MacLean and Guy Burgess abruptly absconded to Russia. An internal mole hunt attempted to out other double agents, and three more SIS employees were soon forced to retire under a cloud of suspicion. John Cairncross, Anthony Blunt, and most famously, Kim Philby, who defected to Moscow after being forced out. As a result of these revelations, tensions were high within the intelligence community. For this reason, April 22, 1956, was a nerve-wracking day for George Blake. Spring of 56 had been a wet one for Berlin, and long-distance cables had been shorting out, requiring Soviet workers to unearth and repair them. What they found underneath was a massive tunnel, the result of Operation Stopwatch, the British-American wiretapping project. But of course, George had told the Soviets about this tunnel years before, and they had allowed it to continue to operate in order to keep their enemies satisfied that they had the upper hand. Using the heavy rains to cover the fact that they'd known all along, First Secretary of the Communist Party, Nikita Khrushchev, had his workers stage the shocking discovery of the tunnel and reveal to the world the treachery and deceit of the West. George was terrified. If word somehow got back to the CIA or SIS that the tunnel discovery had been pre-planned, they would immediately assume there was a mole, and that would put him directly under the microscope. But the intelligence community never caught wind of the Soviets' ploy, and George Blake lived to betray another day. For a few more years, George ran agents in Berlin. He was often assisted by a low-level hustler by the name of Horst Eitner, who called himself Mickey, on account of his uncanny resemblance to Mickey Mouse. Mickey, otherwise, was an SIS officer originally from East Germany. Eventually, George caught wind that Mickey was, in fact, a double agent, working both for the SIS and for the GRU, the main intelligence directorate of the Soviet Union. George kept this information to himself, though, given his own precarious position. Through Mickey, he managed to cultivate a number of Soviet sources, gathering information he could pass back to SIS, though nothing compared to what he was passing to the Soviets. In 1959, one of George Blake's superiors was recalled to London and requested that George relocate as well. That summer, as he departed Berlin after 5 years, he gave little thought to Mickey. That would prove to be a mistake. George was happy to be reassigned to London. By now, he and Jillian had 2 children. His allegiance to the communist and Soviet causes was absolute, but so was his love for his growing family. Leaving Berlin would at least put some distance between him and the Soviets. Perhaps he could retire from intelligence and settle into a quiet life with his family. However, in London, George was put in positions of power and given access to information that only made him more valuable to the Soviets. He began to push for yet another reassignment from his superiors at SIS. George had been eyeing a position in the village of Shimlan, Lebanon, where he hoped to attend the Middle East Center for Arabic Studies. The chance to learn another language was surely appealing, but more importantly, the school represented another chance to distance himself from his life of espionage. After much pleading, his request was granted. George and his family moved to Lebanon. Though he was as far from the Soviet Union as he'd ever been, he was closer to his destruction than he could imagine. At a bar in Berlin, George's former co-worker Mickey was in the midst of a celebration. It was October 15th, 1960. 5 years since his wife, Brigida, had been released from a Siberian prison camp. But the celebration was cut short by a spat between Mickey and Brigida. In a huff, Brigida stormed out of the bar and walked to the nearest police station, where she revealed that her husband, a supposed agent of the SIS, was, in fact, working for Russian intelligence. This was news that the Berlin police found plenty interesting. Mickey, real name Horst Eitner, was arrested hours later, cutting short his revelry at 6 a.m. He was interrogated. At the same time, a Soviet defector from Canberra, Australia, had placed himself under the protection of British authorities. He told them everything he knew, which included the fact that the Berlin office of the SIS had a Soviet spy working in its midst. Mickey gave his interrogators a description of George Blake, whom Mickey had known only under an alias. When they linked this description with the defector's revelations, the shocked SIS officers were quickly able to pin George as the mole. One evening in Shemlan, Lebanon, George Blake and a co-worker took in a show, Charlie's Aunt, a raucous Victorian farce. Against all odds, he enjoyed the performance, and during intermission, he and his co-worker decided to step into a nearby bar for a quick drink. Inside, George was surprised to find himself face to face with Nicholas Elliott, an SIS station chief in Beirut, not far from Shemlan. Elliott informed George that the London SIS office wanted him to return for a quick meeting as soon as possible. Immediately, George's mind began reeling. What could they possibly want with him? He spent a sleepless night considering the possibilities. He could flee to Soviet Russia, seeking protection from his contacts in the KGB, but that would mean leaving his wife and children. And what if he was wrong? To abandon these people he loved so dearly on a hunch? No. He could tell them everything instead, let them decide whether to join him in the Soviet Union as he fled to safety. Hours passed like this, tossing and turning, and then dawn broke. And in the light of day, things somehow seemed less dire. He had been recalled to London unexpectedly before, for any number of routine reasons. Surely, he was simply overreacting. Still, he had to be safe. On a stretch of beach near Beirut, George met with a Russian contact and asked him to look into whether his treason had been discovered. The next day, they met again, with good news. The Moscow office had no reason to suspect the British knew anything. With relief, George pushed aside all thoughts of confessing to his wife, of fleeing, of doing anything but acting the good agent and returning to the London office. Not returning would create even more suspicion, and while his double life was making him anxious, he still believed ardently in his communist cause. After a final tranquil day in Lebanon, George dined with an old friend. The evening closed with a drunken, charming conversation on a balcony overlooking Beirut. Then George packed his bags and headed to the airport. Characteristic London weather greeted George upon landing at Heathrow Airport, a gloomy drizzle that did little to dampen George's continued optimism. He spent the night at his mother's house, where the two stayed up past midnight, warmly catching up on George's adventures in Shemlan. The next morning, Tuesday, April 4th, 1961, George Blake dressed and then made his way to the personnel department in central London. There, he was led to a second building, Carlton Gardens, where George had once worked intercepting transmissions as part of Section Y. His co-workers sat him down, and then they told George Blake why he had been called.